Yes, this I mean this is it's quite common to thank the speakers for the richness of their papers, but it's often a bit hypocritical, but in this case it's really it is really the case. it's really rich what we heard or what I understood of it, and this starts with the multiplicity of historical protagonists you were speaking about. I mean, on the one hand, this group, or it's not really a group, this constellation, this configuration Susanne made up with from the writings and the intellectual and political personae of Wilhelm Hausenstein, Karl Einstein, Louis-Paul Senghor, Aimé Césaire, and Claude McCabe, just to only name a few. I forgot Oscar Bayer and others. And in Sylvie's case, the Boesian, the group of Boesian anthropologists, Margaret Mead, Edward Sapir, Ruth Benedict, and the filmmaker Maya Deren, especially. And this taken all together, it's a rather motley crew, and with interesting connections and overlaps. And I would like to, I mean, both listening to both talks, I had to think about a lack or something's really missing in the exhibition, and which we had to consciously not include. This is that's this kind of sensorial dimension of music in particular, and the very role non-visual and non-representational modes of art making have for those who Susanne was asking or was expecting to intervene into the field of the Weltkunst discourse in the 1920s, or who she was asking how and what along what terms they might have intervened, or they did actually intervene, and the final example of Claude McKay's novel Banjo is an example for using a different sensorial registers to intervene in a given situation of cultural production and of cultural production of the other in particular. And so I would like to start with, because this term came up in both of your talks, with this term of intervention, the intervening of who is intervening in what field and to what conditions. And what is it that an intervention possibly could have been, and a successful intervention at that. And so is there anything you would would you think there is in a way a crossing or a meeting point where the anthropological intervention is kind of meeting this the interventions by those who are excluded from the very field from where the anthropologist, the Western anthropologist, intervened from. Is there an anthropological dimension in the kind of counter-interventions you were referring to, for example?
No. I would say, well, the example of McKay, at least, and so far I only can talk about this example, I mean, it's in a way the complete contrary of an anthropological intervention, because, I mean, he does not, and this is what I found interesting also in your talk, when Meads defines like common human sensuality in a way of this aesthesis, so that this isn't a kind of an, where you see where a certain kind of human commonness is defined as the like commonness of sensuality, which one could say this is a kind of phenomenological approach. But this does not at all, in a way, explain the, how we say, in the way the differences in the class questions and the questions of exploitations, I mean, they are anthropological models which have founded or which are at the base of the system of exploitation, what I was mentioning, saying the naturalization or sexual naturalization of the black body as a primitive working tool. So they are kind of race anthropological assumptions which play into that field, but I would say that Claude McKay, as a very sharp analyzer of contemporary society, of global capitalism, about the harbor as a site of not only where the people meet, but also a lot of goods meet, how this moral subjectivity is shaped. And this is, a very non-anthropological conception of community. So in this case, I would say no.
Well, I would say that cultural relativism is an intervention itself, and it was a really powerful one, I think. So, which also made, for example, which gave some enabling structures for the work of Zora Neale Hurston, for example, in this borderland of anthropology and art. But I also think you can, we have to think about what we mean by intervention then. So I think it's not an intervention that with which I'm fully satisfied, or which I would take as an example for, or which I would put on a podest or something. But I think at that time it was a necessary critique on within anthropology itself, which was dominated by racist evolutionism, and also as a public voice in all these in this very racist atmosphere of talking about migration, of talking different different kinds of people, and so I think. I think you might say that there was an intervention, and a necessary one as well.
No, but I think, like, in order to answer this question properly, I mean, it's, for me, it was the question in a way in how far you think like the situatedness of interventions. I mean, even Karl Einstein or a lot of these art historical discourses and Oscar Bayer and Wilhelm Hausenstein, I mean, they were certainly very critical of their times, and they were against the grain of most art historical writings, also by accusing this kind of like newly racist, Germanizing art historicity or art history writing. But then for me, the question is, how far do these interventions into a certain discourse get, and at which price? And I think this is for me a little bit the question, like, who pays the price for, like, using non-European art for kind of undoing a certain, or for criticizing, intervening in a certain high cultural discourse, also from the question, like a class question, but then, what I said, at which price or at which expenses, and then trying to analyze this more as in a bigger constellation, where you can see in how far, there was a price, and the price was never getting into contact about the people you talked about.
Mm. Yeah, this is this is interesting also in those very situations, like the harbor cities of the in the interwar years, where there might have been a lot of, there had been contact between very different groups of very different origin and very different, but a lot of different class. This was generally a kind of underclass, a proletarian constituency that met under very particular conditions. And this was probably one of the few contact or grounds of or situations of contact where this where the contact really happened. It didn't happen, for example, happened in the Paris of the late 1920s, early 30s, when people like Langston Hughes were dishwashing in the same bars, or where probably white anthropologists or artists interested in ethnology socialized. So there's so this kind of non-meeting, I think, or the this intervention that doesn't meet the opponent or only is only meeting it or him or her in a violent way is something to be further thought about. The other, I mean, there's a bunch of things I would we could discuss. The way in which the theme of crisis or exhaustion, this kind of tragic of fatigue that you've been speaking about, is in a way the common ground for all of those projections and all of those interventions that also the anthropologists found. The Boasian anthropologists found the kind of wholeness and the kind of union or communion they were missing in their own. Environments in the Western world, the capitalized world, and so there is in a way this interesting point of this tipping point where these situation or this condition of alienation is becoming a productive ground for people like Claude McKay or for a kind of heterodox surrealism around. Document as a newspaper, but is there anything to be found like this, like a base materialism, the kind of Bataillon base materialism that Claude McKay, for example, is very fond of in cultural anthropology, an interest in the low, in a kind of non-celebratory whole. yeah.
I would also say, it was like the opposite. It was the search for this. It was constantly the urge to create this whole. And so I would say no, too. I just told you about this example of mothers bathing their babies, and I also watched through the whole film material at the Library of Congress. I tried to re-step or I retake Deren Step, who worked herself through this material, and the constant repetitions make you crazy. You see different people. Like she says, different people at different times doing over and over the same thing, and it literally makes you crazy. So it is an obsession with creating this whole. Obviously it wasn't there, it was made. So
well, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, and please anthropologists should correct me, but I think in a way what Bataillon, at least what they did in Document, in a way was this kind of an interjection of a former projection. So in a way the fascination also with the so-called other, at least how you can see it like in Wollinger or Hausenstein, in a way wasn't fascination with the barbaric. What was a fascination, I don't know whether I wouldn't call it low, but at least it was what when Bayer rejected the prejudices that everything which is barbaric just is a Ausgeburt dunkler, dumpfer Triebe. In a way you can see through this negation what the common discourse was. And in a way this kind of like Ausgeburt dunkler, dumpfer Triebe in a way is something which Bataille put back into like the own society, talking about the big toe as the most neglected body part.
Since we are I mean, we're good in time, but I think we should, if there are already questions in the audience, I would like to open up the discussion to the floor. There's one. We have microphones, haven't we? Yeah.
Hi, yes, thank you both for wonderful conversations today. To linger one on the interventions point, sorry, is my Scottish accent okay for everyone to understand? I realise sometimes I speak a bit quickly. The point of interventions is something that, Susanna, you mentioned the Weimar period and the kind of otherness of the Weimar is always interesting because I think there are multiple others coming out in this period, sexual others, gendered others, racialized others especially. And you also showed Sylvie the Spies piece. Spies is hugely problematic, of course, because it's a particular view. But I wondered then if, in reaction to the Spies, and shown in the exhibition that's here, if you've all seen it or not, are Hannah Hoech and her series of the Ethnographisches Museum. And these interventions of classical bodies in the white or Western construction, geklebt with these ethnographic bodies, Etruscan or African or other. Is there an intervention there of the two cultures being intervened or being reconstituted in a sense that they are no longer so different? And it's what made me think about when you said about the hours and hours of babies being bathed. It's the banalitäten. It's the banal of the everyday. These lives are no different to ours here. It's just in a different context, no? And I wonder if there is something about intervention in the sense of taking away that otherness, in the sense of washing over the two as the same, in leveling the two. I wonder if there's a response in intervention in that sense. I don't know if that made sense or not as a question, but perhaps.
You want?
I guess there was the urge to do that, but it doesn't really, with the film material of Mead and Bateson, or the film Mead put together with this material later on in the 50s, it definitely doesn't work. It is. with the films of Maya Deren, I think there you have especially the Haiti material, and you can compare the patterns because they were both sides were very much interested in trance, in the phenomenon of possession, and you also have Hurston making films about trance. So you can and there are different modes of making these films, and I think with Deren, who's like kind of moving, the camera is moving in the ritual. She's dancing while she's taking these films. I think there, I would say there are moments where it works, but I would really pick up on this notion of moments. There are moments where it might work, but I'm very skeptical, and it's very it shakes you while watching this material. So I think, because the otherness is kind of the point, right? The otherness is the thing which you love. The otherness is the thing which you want to bring home and show to the others. So this impetus of showing, of grasping it and then showing, that never leaves this material. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm also maybe a bit skeptical, at least in terms of Hannah Hoech, and I think it would be interesting also to hear from other, like, people here in the room or the conference participants what they think about the question, because I think it's in this respect important, because like in Hannah Hoech, referring on the ethnographic museum at this time, and then also, I mean, she uses a lot of material from newspapers, journals, who all deal with this so-called Schmach am Rhein, so that Germany was like ruled by French military, which was mostly like with a lot of like black soldiers taking part, and then this kind of like shock of the poor Germans to be governed, by this mixed army, So in a way, Hannah Höch was certainly intervening in this discourse, but in a way, still, I mean, she remains very much within the frame you can do within the ethnographic. I think it's a lot she did, also criticizing these museums in a way in the constructions of otherness. But I'm wondering, I don't know, in how far, if your own concept are so much framed by this construction of otherness, which you meet in ethnographic museums, how you can transcend it only relying on that visual material and not by other forms of, I don't know, meeting collaboration, but I don't know, maybe others have a better answer to this.
Frank Hofmann, Sontobat Bloch, ich wollte auf den Schlusspunkt von Susanne Liebs Vortrag zurückkommen mit der Perspektive auf Banjo von McKay. Aus literaturwissenschaftlicher Sicht kann man das sehr gut nutzen, um die Frage nach den Literaturen der Welt zu den Literaturmonde hinzuwenden und nach der Welthaltigkeit der Literatur zu fragen. Das ist eine Analogie, Susanne. Was bedeutet das für die Weltkunst? Zu fragen, wie kommt Welt in die Kunst oder Welthaltigkeit in die Literatur? Und bei diesem Banjo-Roman ist ja zum einen die Figur, die du entwickelt hast, über diese Gemeinschaftsbildung wichtig, aber eben auch eine Form von Realismus, die genau in dieser Story without a plot liegt, also dem Verzicht auf Erzählung, das Starkmachen von Umgangssprachlichkeit, also diese Dimension. Und das fand ich eine Frage, die in dem Kontext interessant zu diskutieren wäre nochmal. Wie kommt Welt in die Literatur oder Welt in die Kunst? Und das nicht als Kanonfrage zu diskutieren oder als Wertungsfrage, welche Literatur hat welchen Platz im Gattungsgefüge oder im Hierarchisierungsgefüge von Weltliteratur.
Ja, das ist, I'm answering in English. In so far interesting, because I think in McKay it's very multi-layered, because it's everything you said, but then also the world is also, all the goods which are extensively described in the novel, which come arrive, and the ships which arrive. So it's really also the world of world commerce. In the world art history books, I mean, it's in this respect very different, because the notion of world which they constructed was usually by the notion of style, and completely abstracting from these very concrete material. But then, abstracting and finding or trying to retrieve different styles in every art, like of the whole world, and then being able to compare. And in a way, the world art was, at least when you look at historians like Karl Lamprecht, a compensation for the impossibility to write world history. And he was convinced that writing world history is only possible through aesthetic objects, because you can distract a style from them and then construct like lines how all the world, the art of of the whole world is connected, and then kind of find this world. But this world is a very different world than the one McKay analyzes.
Thinking about a lot of things, and this is, I don't know if this is a question or just a kind of short comment. But to the question of interventions and the limitations on interventions, which I think Susanne has made us very aware of, and it is very extremely important to be aware of. I think that my sense is that one might take a historical view of the limitations, the kinds of contacts and the kinds of historical possibilities or possibilities of relationship that we would be wanting and that we see lacking in the work of this work during the 20s and 30s, it really can't happen until after 1950. We need decolonization. There's a real tournant, there's a real turning that happens. I'm not saying there was not resistance to colonization before. Of course there was. But it wasn't really a world it wasn't on the world stage. It wasn't a historical force, really, until after 1950. And once that starts to happen, then I think the possibilities for, in this case, anthropological knowledge, open up. Things become contested. Things that were taken for granted are no longer taken for granted. But we can't really expect to find that in the 20s and 30s. We need to notice it, but we can't be holding their feet to the fire, I don't think. We can see how the orders that they're creating have subversion built into them. And that I think this exhibition does very well. And I think in this discussion, especially of the Boasians, it was very, very clear. For example, the poem by Sapir, which describes a photographic encounter, you know, he takes a stop, hold it, take a picture, and then, okay, I've got it. Now you can go on, you know, time will continue, but I've got the moment. So it's a moment of appropriation. I mean, you could see it as a metaphor for ethnography. As Lévi-Strauss said so well in Tristes Tropiques, ethnography takes place in a particular moment, and by virtue of going, attending to that moment, it's missing everything else. You know, it's missing all those other historical periods, and he writes about that very poignantly in Tristes Tropiques. And but for Sapir, is it a problem? Is it or not? He notices it, though. He notices what he's getting and what is escaping. Necessarily escaping. And so we get to some of the aporias of ethnography, and the two that I think of right away are that one, the fact that time will not stand still. Time always exceeds its representation. It always subverts whatever textualization or collection, or that metaphor that those Boasians loved so much, the laboratory metaphor. You know, Mead and Benedict talking about this, we're constructing a laboratory of worlds, of social forms and world cultures, where they even use the phrase, they're at, what's the phrase, near at hand or easy at, easy,
right there at all hands.
In our hand, readily available. All the world's cultures, just right here for us to work with. Well, I mean, come on. But they were serious about that. They used that. It was partly that they had science envy, and the laboratory was a way of seeming scientific. They even talked about the field as a laboratory, fieldwork as a laboratory. And Clifford Geertz said at one point, what kind of laboratory is it when every variable is uncontrolled? But the Boasians took that seriously. But when you think about this laboratory of collected cultures, these kind of collections, the inertness of those cultures, the fact that time has stopped in the case, as with all of the objects that have come into ethnographic collections where their ongoing life is stopped at the moment of collecting and the conservators won't let anyone touch them except with those special gloves because they might get a little bit dirty or something, as though they had not been very dirty before that moment, arbitrary moment of collection. Anyway, the stopping of time that takes place in ethnographic, in the construction of these laboratories and collections and this data is it's just so clear, and you can see that Sapir is aware of it. And my other thought, just that came to mind, was when Sylvie was saying very well about those, I don't know if you've ever seen these movies that Meads and Maid about Bali, but Margaret Mead was a kind of crazy empiricist. And she wanted to set up the camera and not just let it run, you know? Just let it run, because she thought, well, if I move the camera around and take pictures, then I'm imposing, you know, my subjectivity on it. And this should be science. So the camera has to be stable on a tripod, and Balinese society, culture, will take place in front of it. And I will record it. Well, all I can think of is Andy Warhol. You know, I come in. Have you ever tried to look at his Empire State Building, you know, film where he just lets the camera run for 24 hours at the Empire State Building? I mean, this is the subversion by time of the and space by of this fixing methodology that is not just true of anthropology at this moment. It's true of all textualization and all representation, and it just seemed to be very clear these aporias that anthropology works within about stopping and gathering multiple temporalities which absolutely cannot be contained. That just seemed to come across in all of these very clearly for me, so thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we should collect the last two questions before, and then maybe we have not much time left. Marion von Osten had a question over there. No, there, please. And Joyce Chang.
Shall I start?
Yeah.
Okay. For me, it came to my mind the role of the metropolis, also in relation to Marseille and also Paris, for anti-colonial discourse, for the gathering of other ideas and the question of intervention. And also in relation to Banjo, this might have been for Adolf Hitler the most kind of horrible, ever written literature because of the decay of the city. You know, the idea that the city is in crisis, that, you know, the society is falling apart, it's about a prostitution, exploitation. So it's actually it's an anti-Nazi book as such, because it is placing itself in the pervert idea of being together with different people, even having some other forms of sex and so on. So I think it's a kind of very interesting form of intervention, but it's an intervention into the metropolis as well. And so that would be my question to both of you. Isn't that all what you have summarized for us? Discourses from the metropolises and also then projection onto other villages. Because the people that were under study are usually people that are not part of the metropolis, but then the intervention into that discourse from Paris, from Senghor, or in Banjo, comes again from the metropolis. So this is actually the field where I'm able to intervene. Am I able to intervene from the village, would be my question, into that discourse that you're describing.
Maybe I just kind of continue because this is actually now irrelevant to my question. So my question is about cultural relativism, right, as a position that we have more or less come to accept as progressive, as representing a kind of progressivist trend of maybe modern Western thought. So, of course, it's a product of Western modernity as well. But I think in both of your talks, it becomes clear that nowhere is the idea of cultural relativism more undermined by upholding one form of culture as the norm, right? So the idea that primitive societies in all of its forms, right, whatever that means, should actually serve as a paradigm, this very idea seems to me already undermines the idea of cultural relativism. Because in a way, they're still searching for some kind of instructive model that will teach us how culture ought to be, right? And I think you would have a number of ways of addressing this question, but I also was very struck by how most of the time when they project their own, the Western ethnographers, ethnologists, poets and critics and artists, when they project whatever they lack upon so-called primitive cultures, often it's upon pagan forms of religiosity, right? So when you talk about spirituality, they're usually not talking about monotheistic forms of spirituality. It's usually the model is ancient Greek and Hindu, Bali, African animism, this kind. So I just can't help, as a person who didn't come from a Judeo-Christian background, and maybe I have this as a privilege too, to say that there's something about this, and then this idea of the metropolis, right, the falling Babylon, you know, there's something about this that really reeks of a kind of disenchanted monotheistic, post-monotheistic cultural mentality. So I don't know if you have a response to that, because, of course, this idea of vitality and a kind of a richly spiritual life, to me sounds very much Edenic, right? So.
I'm just thinking maybe I could add my question because it might actually also fit into that and make a trilogy. And that would be more or less like directed at the concept you've mentioned from the Fabrikation der Fiktionen, which I sense has something to do with what has just been put on the table, which is this Funktionsumkehr. How would one translate that? The reversal of function, the inversion of function of myth, right? That is a kind of one of the most contested terms in the Einsteinian universe. No? In the Braque monograph, he praises Braque for being a kind of first poet, for making myth real again, for by way of reaching the deeper strata or dressing deeper strata that are collective, and in the Fabrikation der Fiktionen, in the Fabrication of Fictions book, more or less from the same time, he kind of denounces that mythomanic project of modernism as precisely failing to produce a new collectivity, and giving all kind of interesting analyses for that, no? As the metamorphic obsession of modernism is in fact just mirroring what finance is doing, what capital is doing. It's the mana that runs like mana, like money through everything, etc. So he has the kind of strange a multitude of different interpretations for this, but what remains there is an event there. No? This Funktionsumkehr is in itself somehow something that I think then might relate or might fuel in its other manifestations, perhaps less specifically analyzed than in the Einsteinian universe, this kind of quest for wholeness and the whole question of community and something about the efficacy and the function of art hinges on that the status of myth production and who's able to do that and with what collective effect. So I just wanted to add that to the Metropolis question.
Obviously, I don't want to be the defender of the Boasians, which would be stupid. but I think it is. I think when we are thinking about how anthropological knowledge production is, how that can work as a critique in the present and in the future, I think. It is, for me, it is too easy to say that cultural relativism is making these dichotomies like which serves only the West. I think this, which is right, and I don't want to. Say something against that, but I think all those elements which reflect, for example, the baggage of the words, which try to experiment with different media to which reflect on this also on this colonial configuration in which they were. I think in order to talk about critique, we have to take or we have to look upon these ambivalent aspects, which, and I think in the exhibition, you can see those ambivalent aspects all the time. And I think it's important not to entangle them, but to accept them in this messiness. And it is messy. It is not something that is right or that can be used for today's analysis. And oh my God, I would never. I hope that you've understood that right. I mean, I didn't want to propose like a Boasian way of cultural analysis. But I also think that, for example, looking at the poems, it's not enough to read Zapier into the poem and to try to read his intention out of this text. I think the text works more in more complicated ways. So this is what I tried to. I didn't want to deproblematize the primitivism of early cultural anthropologists. And to the metropolis, I think there are these really interesting connections, for example, between the Chicago School of Urban Studies and the Boasians. Edward Zapier, for example, taught at Chicago, and these connections between Dewey and Boas, who also taught a seminar together at Columbia, and Park, who was a student of Dewey. So, and the city in Chicago, you can see that very well, that the city, there is like a parallel configuration between the dark corners and areas of the city and the dark corners at somewhere else in the world, where and the city was a laboratory for, and the laboratory expression as well was very much in pragmatist thought was like conceptualized in connection to the city. So yes, I think you're very right, and maybe you can. There's much more to say, but we'll just stop here.
Yeah. Well, only one line. I mean, sure, you're completely right that this is a very metropole discourse, and I think what you might ask for is something which has to be done in a completely different research in this respect, and how far like the investigated people inscribe themselves into the scientific material through which they were investigated. And there are a lot of like examples but this is a completely different model, certainly, of participating in a certain discourse, but something which tries to micropolitically interfere in these kind of mechanisms of domination on a really lower level. And then there is this whole other discourse, but then again it's more a metropolis, a more intellectual discourse, the whole questions in the 60s, how to reconnect to the people, like in order, like which was then why like Negritude was accused that it was not really relating to the people, and then how to, like if you want to make a revolution, if you want to gain economic independence, then you really have to connect. It just only can come from the people. But this is in a way also an intellectual claim or necessity, which is not necessarily answering to articulated needs, but says that it's needed for the revolution. So I think, but these are maybe two possible ways to address your question. But the other one is really like needs a meticulous research. For example, like the Principio Potosí Ausstellung, which happened here, it was shown like how people who had to paint according to like the plantain press. Alice already has left, so she could tell you more about it. So when in Bolivia, people had to paint these Christian paintings that they inscribed their local, I don't want to say customs, but something like that, and their own view, and also their notions of exploitation into these paintings, which are difficult maybe to decipher for someone who only recognizes the Baroque. But if you look more closely, you see that. So okay, this is maybe one attempt to answer. Then the pagan. I was running from the head through all my material, and I mean it's almost. I mean, I can only answer this, but maybe you have much more in your mind, which you could contribute to that certainly. But this is more also a very Eurocentric discourse that certainly like the discovery of the Dionysic moments in Nietzsche, I mean, all this reverberates through the whole discourse, and this kind of also looking for the Dionysian moments, the orgy, as something which is completely like anti-classical again. And there you find moments in the writing. Gottfried Semper and other ones who exactly try to use that as a different model of democracy, a model from like a real, like really from the demos, and which is colorful and not white compared to the like anti-classicist. Yeah, but this is, I mean, yeah.
So I think thank you very much for all the great questions and for the conversation, your talks. This was a very long session. We will recon.